it was a team full of egos who didn't want to do anything for each other. But that was a pity, because we knew that if Cruyff was there, he could put that all back.
But you almost managed to put it all back.
Yeah, if the Federation had listened to us.
But even in the tournament, you play well enough to only go out.
Yeah, it was a strange thing when we played against Germany in Milan. We were better than the Germans. We had a lot of chances. Then, yeah, that moment of, with Rijkaard happened, and then it changed the whole game. It was a strange thing. But, it was all already to happen, already up front.
It was too late.
Strange.
So the bones of the defeat had happened. Does that sound
strange? Is that
Does it take away any of the sense of enjoyment you have from your international career?
No,
because you're still.
It is what it is.
You're still the only Dutch captain to lift silverware.
Yeah, but we are very proud of the fact that we had silverware as a small country that we are.
Yeah,
three times in the finals of a World Cup. Come on, we are very happy about that.
So the other falling out in 1994, does that rankle?
No, that is how we are, the Dutch. We have an opinion. We have, and sometimes you regret it. After that, you think, maybe I should have gone, but no.
Is that one that you regret?
Yeah, I regret it. But it was the heat of the moment. It was how I felt at that moment, and that happens.
Because you can't go back and change these things, obviously.
No, but you only can say honestly about facts like, maybe I did wrong.
Just to go back, right, because when did you get good at this stuff? When did you realise that you were actually a bloody-minded, stubborn, good goal kicker, wants to run the game type person?
But that's... I didn't kick in school, you know what I mean? There was Eddie Hogan O'Connell was my scrum half in school, and he was a better kicker. So it kind of hit me one day, which wouldn't be allowed to happen nowadays, I suppose. Well, you'd be lost, I presume, but it was only kind of 18 or 19. You're kind of thinking, if I want to play out half, I've got to kick a goal. Otherwise, there's someone else in the back line that needs to kick, so you're really restricting your possibilities to be picked.
Yeah. Is this because it's around this time that you're turning professional?
But I don't think professional was an issue. It was kind of, praise, it was pretty intense. It was good. I loved rugby. I still love rugby, obviously, but that's what I did, and then went to university, and that's what I did. And because I got 7,500 to sign a professional contract, I don't think changed anything.
It kind of changed your life, though, right?
It changed.
Like the path of your life changed at that moment.
Perhaps, yeah, the perception of my life. But for me, I don't think it changed, and hopefully that's why there's so many people here, hopefully, tonight. The fact that I tried and I gave it my best shot, but I hope, to think it didn't change me, because I still have my same buddies from school. I still have, hopefully, the same values, and that's what's important to me, really,
When you got the job, I remember looking back at old YouTube footage of speeches you'd given in the past, and I remember seeing a particular bit where you described a journey, a very long journey from Derry by car to Croke Park to watch Derry playing, I think, in an All-Ireland football final, and perhaps your brother was playing in the game. And I remember watching that and thinking, Jesus, this actually means something to Martin O'Neill coming back to Ireland to manage the international team, that these are his people and he's amongst them. And to be honest, listening to you talk about how you pick the team and why you want the team to play the way they do, it does sound like it is part of who we are, and it speaks to us, I think, and it speaks to the fans too.
Well, I think perhaps maybe some of that comes from the comes really from managing Celtic, where you would get droves of people coming from all over Ireland to come and support the team. They'd come over in boats, they'd be in planes, there'd be busloads from Donegal arriving at Celtic Park. And we were. And in my time now, we were averaging 60,000 people. There was 55,000 season ticket holders at Celtic, and there were a lot from Ireland. So I think that big Irish connection there had maybe something to do with it. So I never felt ill at ease in that sense. But like anything else, regardless of all the hype, for want of a better word, when you start off with something, I think you have to try and have an end product, otherwise it kind of becomes useless. It's a wee bit like a manager stepping in into a job, and whether it be at club level or anything, and saying he wants to do this, wants to criticise everything that happened behind him, that type of stuff, and then 5 or 6 weeks into the job, fallen a sword. I never felt like that. I thought that Mr. Trapattoni had done exceptionally well.
What's that process like? How do you transform yourself then from being somebody who, is it Jay Larson says, nah, these guys are heavyweights here, Vandy, you just stay here. How do you go from that to the point where you're thinking, no, screw that, I'm stepping up and I'm gonna do this?
Well, we said go, and he said, okay, when you become the undisputed cruiserweight champion, then we'll move up. In which, you know, main events was my promoter, and they came with a scheme saying they called the Omega Project. Evander Holyfield, the Omega Project. We're going to take a cruiserweight and we're going to build him up, and he's going to come and take over and be the heavyweight champion of the world.
I've had so many kind of ups and downs myself over the last 2 years, and you learn as you go along how to control yourself. So it took everything in my power, to be honest, but I laughed it off, thank God. But I will be honest, it did take me everything to control that, you know.
Because you said to Sean that you get used to it, and that was actually one of the most chilling things. So what was said was gross, but the fact that it happens so often that you somehow have to internalise a coping mechanism to deal with, it's just, that's awful. Like, how do you ever get used to something like that?
I don't know. As I said, like if it was anyone else, to be fair, like anyone that hasn't kind of been through hardships and stuff, they wouldn't be able to control it. You couldn't control that kind of thing. But I just think, as I said, everything's a learning curve, and like I've been kicked down so many times from, you know, friends and people in the past that it is just something that you learn to take on the chin. I don't know, maybe I'm stronger than I think, but to be honest, I actually don't even know. I think it just kind of comes naturally to me as time has gone on, where it's in one ear and out the other. You literally just focus on, you know, your game and your game plan, and you try to block everything else out. So to be honest, yeah, I think it's kind of natural where I just completely block any negativity out of my game whatsoever. And I don't know how I do it at times.
When you're in that room on your own, you know, you do tend to think an awful lot of things, and you tend to worry. Whereas if you got someone to talk to, you know, breaks the board and breaks the monotony, like you go watch a movie or you'd watch the football or you do something. But I'd never like to stay in the room for too long. No.
Yeah, because we've actually already spoken to Willie in the interview. He's gone out at 5:30 today. But we were talking about, so Willie obviously had his various problems. He's addicted to gambling.
Yeah.
We had Jimmy White in talking about being addicted to crack cocaine and burning
furniture.
Burning furniture in a hotel in Kildare.
I know.
And obviously Alex Higgins. Yeah. And I was just wondering, is there something specific about snooker that, like, you know, you spend a lot of time in darkened rooms?
I don't do drugs, Claire. I don't even go to hash bars like Tommy does in Amsterdam. I'd rather go to the Rijksmuseum than a hash bar and say hello to two lads in the corner. I get stoned by osmosis, but no.
There's me in a hash bar and Ken at Aunt Frank's house.
No, I mean, they were the few sort of ones that would be, but that would stand out, the likes of Alex and Jimmy and even Ronnie and stuff like that. And players have suffered from, you know, depression and may have turned to drugs as well, but they're few and far between. I mean, of all the snooker players that are on the tour, you know, there's
it's just that they're very high profile cases.
Even now, a lot of the guys, I wouldn't say a lot of them would be, you know, drinking maybe, but drugs, no, not at all.
Not so much even the drugs, just that, like, it's an
depression,
an addictive lifestyle.
It is an addictive lifestyle, yeah. But you have to be to play snooker. Well, you have to be, because you have to be in a way very insular, you know, because you know you're on your own all the time. You know what I mean? It's a single, you know, it's a solitary sport, and you spend a lot of hours on your own. You spend a lot of traveling on your own.
That's why it's interesting to hear you say you wanted someone to travel with. So yeah, you're not like I'm actually. Because 7 hours a day, it's just you and this group of balls in a weird constellation that you're trying to control.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it is. Yeah, it is very, very tough mentally.
thankfully we finished up with the best world championships we ever have, and I didn't want to steal the thunder of the boxers that came back with the medals on when we got back on the Friday, so I waited until the weekend and put in my resignation, and that was it.
It doesn't sound like you have any regrets, though. Like, it doesn't sound like you're looking back and thinking you'd love to now be with the Irish lads. Maybe it does sound like you would like to be with them heading into the Olympic Games, given all the work that you've done. But at the same time, it also sounds like you have made an accommodation in your own mind that the clean break was the right thing to do.
Yeah, I think so. Look at that team. I love that team. And it took me, you know, that 8 months. In that 8 months, I spent many nights on my own crying. And the thoughts of it. And I knew then when I was gone, I knew I spent days and days. I just broke down in tears thinking about leaving. Because it was like, it is your family. And it was part of your family. And it was a very difficult move to make. But once I made it and I moved there, I had this peace of being able to move on very quickly. But when I got here, I just felt, you know what? I'm really outside of my comfort zone. I'm being challenged like I've never been challenged before. And, you know, I was really enjoying it. I was excited. And I said, you know, this is the right move for me. It was the time for me to move. I got to the stage where we could do what we were doing in Ireland while I was standing on my head. And it became easy. And so, you know, I was here every day, every minute, every training session, everything that I do is a challenge because people, first of all, they find it hard to understand me with my Wexford accent. So. And secondly, they don't understand the language I'm speaking about as regards amateur boxing, the style and the fundamental movements of that. They don't understand it. So I've been breaking barriers for every day. And every day there's a new guy or a new girl coming on board. So you've got to go back all over again and start again. So I'm really excited about what I've seen and about the challenges that lie ahead of me here and to come to another nation. And to try and make it a success, it's a real joy for me, and hopefully that will be the case.
I one last thing: is there pressure in all that too? Then, like the fact that this is the U.S. amateur boxing team.
Absolutely, there is always pressure. There is expectation around everything we did in Ireland. There's expectation, you know, for the last couple of Olympic Games. You know, everybody thought the boxers were going to win medals. You know, who was going to win the medals? The boxers. So. Everybody, the pressure was on us, but the pressure is maybe something that it comes with its territory. You know, you're a sports manager, you're a sports coach. That is the nature of the business. Nobody wants to be more successful than the manager or the coach. You know, he knows his job. He knows he's there to be successful. I'm here to be successful.
And then you find the story growing and growing and growing until 1966 when Raymond Smith, the famous old journalist, Sunday Press journalist, says, "Finally, I found one." He said, "I was in a pub on Middle Abbey Street just now, and I had a pint with a man who told me that he'd been paid 5 shillings a load for carrying the rubble up from the GPO to Croke Park."
Wow!
So the story was essentially a confection.
We grew up on that story, like totally told it. Oh, that's right.
The idea it's a crazy idea that O'Reilly's car was buried amongst the rubble.
The O'Reilly's car. Yeah, that's the ultimate one. O'Reilly had driven around in 1916, just before the rising, scooted around the city trying to help the rebels in various shapes or forms. And the myth, as published in the biography of O'Reilly, is that his car was buried beneath the hill.
Look, it's very difficult to get to the truth of all this stuff. I suspect, and that's the power of the myth and why they, you know, you tell the story, get it repeated, and suddenly it becomes fact. And that's the power. That's why they start.
Especially if you publish it in official documentation, and it's published in official GAA documentation until the 1980s.
Yeah,
it's repeated, and the story still lingers on. Of course.
Yeah.
But it's actually set out publicly. And it's also set out in history books that, for example, there's a history book from the 1940s which says the British Army tried to get the GAA men to recruit in 1940, 1950, 1916. Mm-hmm. But it failed singularly. None of them joined. So stories get... It's a two-way story.
A couple of things. Are you too close to the anti-doping agencies of each of the countries? So you take the controversy around the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight, for example, and USADA giving a therapeutic use exemption to Pacquiao for an IV, or for to Mayweather for an IV. And it's like, that's weird, because the USADA are getting paid by the Nevada State Boxing Commission. That's a conflict of interest. And I didn't really hear WADA come out and say, lads, you have to stop this, because it actually undermines all the great work that you've done about around Lance Armstrong, for example.
Well, I've not been asked any question about Mayweather-Pacquiao until you just asked it. So I haven't commented until now. We reviewed that. It was subject of a separate contract between USADA and the authority, the Nevada people, for the testing program. It's not conducted under their National Anti-Doping Agency normal testing program. So I haven't even read the conditions of that contract, and I can't comment on what happened. I read about it, and I addressed it directly with USADA to say, what have you done? And they said, we just proceeded according to the contract. But it wasn't monitored by us. It wasn't a test taken under a sport which has co-compliant rules.
Right. And to the public, that sounds dodgy.
Well, that's really then a question for boxing to address. And we've been saying for many years that boxing is a disparate group of private promoters who have all sorts of different ways of doing things. Why don't they come together under one umbrella?
So, likewise, this the story at the weekend, you guys are not commenting at the moment on UK anti-doping stuff, but that sounds weird to us as well. Like, we need WADA to be the one saying what the UK anti-doping agency did by not referring that doctor to the General Medical Council is wrong. And so I've heard you say that the doctor shouldn't be practicing. Okay, and that's fine. But you're the figurehead of the anti-doping community, and it looks like one of your star pupils has seriously boo-booed here.
And they're now subject to an independent inquiry, and I don't want to interfere with that process. But we will certainly comment when that's finished. We'll certainly comment.
Harry, a lot of people who live outside of the sports world talk about tragedy putting sport in context. But just reading about what happened to you and your wife, it seems as if sport was a bit of a release and actually something really important for you to get back to, as opposed to, you know, something not important.
Yeah, it definitely was for me. You know, looking back at that time, you know, football was, you know, the only thing that was keeping me going. You know, without a shadow of a doubt, it's the amount of support that I had from everyone all across the world was amazing, really. And my close ones and my loved ones were, you know, really touched by all the support. But it definitely does, you know, it does put football and everything into perspective, really. When anything happens tragedy-wise, it always seems it does, which is unfortunate. That it has to be something so tragic sometimes to make everyone realise how lucky they are just to be healthy, to have a healthy family. Sometimes it takes a highlighted tragedy to realise that.
Yeah, I wonder what the long-term impact for you is. Like, are you changed as a man because of this? I mean, obviously you are, but how do you feel you are?
Yeah, I always personally believe, you know, actions speak a hell of a lot louder than words. You know, it'd be easy for anyone to say, you know, it's changed me for this, it's changed me for that. But deep inside, I feel a completely different person. You know, I look at the world in a totally different light, which is a shame, really, that it took something, as I said there, so tragic to make me feel and realise and treat things and, you know, certain people differently. But for every, you know, anything bad that happens, something good does come from it, I guess. You know, probably the change in me is probably what I needed.
Can I ask you then about the decision to go public with the tragedy that you and your wife suffered? Because so many people decide that they want to hide these things away. They feel shame or embarrassment, or it's very difficult to talk about these things. But your decision to go public, I think, gives so much strength to people who might have suffered something similar. And I know you don't, you know, it's obviously not part of your thinking at all, where you become a spokesperson, where you become, you know, identified with this in the minds of people, but it's actually an important thing too.
Yeah, I've got to be honest, that was never really part of the reasons why I went public with my personal life. You know, before the Manchester United game, I felt like I had to, purely down to the fact that unfortunately, what did happen, I did half break down a little bit. I was close to killing the ref at one point in the game. And I felt before the game I probably had to tell everyone what the reasons why I probably wasn't in the right mental state. But going on from that, you know, it gave me a going public and speaking to people about it, gave me a nice a nice feeling inside. You know, I'm sure everyone grieves in different ways, but, you know, even now talking about it, it fills me with, you know, happiness, really. I love people to recognise that, you know, I had a little girl and she did exist, and I feel proud talking about her.